rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful Monday morning. Our quote for the day from former Democratic President Woodrow Wilson. A conservative is a man who sits and thinks, but mostly sits. Coming up on today's program, George Lakoff is here with his new book, Who's Freedom? The Battle Over America's Most Important Idea. That'll be in our second hour. In the third hour of our program, we'll be talking with Kathy Cassavant of the AFL-CIO about how working people are squeezed as never before. And with Gonzo, the managing editor at BuzzFlash.com, for the best of the rest of the news, what's been happening in the news over the last week, over the weekend, and that sort of thing. Catch us up to date and bring us up to speed on everything that's going on. A pile of stuff in the news today, by the way, ranging from what's going on in Mexico, a yellow revolution brewing. Is this going to be a repeat of what we saw in the Ukraine? Could it be 900,000 people showing up this weekend in Mexico City saying, no, we want our votes to be counted. We want our election to be solid. We want to know that it's real. American highways being sold off. This is a whole other scandal. The Bush administration is privatizing Medicare. They've privatized a good chunk of the accounting out to 3M Corporation in a no-bid contract. What's the upshot of that? Well, it looks like it's going to be 33% cut in stents. For heart disease, 23% cut if you want to have a defibrillator like Dick Cheney implanted. If you need a hip replacement, they're going to cut that 10% or a knee replacement, something like that. So weirdness continuing in the Bush plan to privatize Medicare. Of course, they'd like to privatize Social Security as well. The Ministry for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice has come back with the Taliban in Afghanistan. The government itself now, Hamid Karzai, voted for this thing. That, a whole bunch more. We've got a whole lot of stuff to cover here today. But first, Lawrence Krauss is with us. He's with TaxFreeSociety.com, his website. He was a candidate for governor of New York in 2006 and is author of the book, The Morally Good Politician. Hey, Lawrence, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. The information that you sent us and the literature that you sent us basically suggests startling ways the government wastes your tax dollars every day. You think that we should have a tax-free society? Why are you such a freeloader?
Well, that's a interesting way of looking at it. In order to have a tax-free society, you really need to reduce the size of government tremendously so that, in my concept, an endowment or a trust fund could pay for security like police, courts, and defense so that people don't have to pay taxes anymore.
The police, courts, and defense. Now, I'm assuming that you don't care if your water is pure.
Well, oh, sure I do. And even today, people are concerned about that. But a lot of times they buy bottled water. They buy filtration systems on their own.
So if you're rich enough to buy a bottled water, then you're fine. And if you're a poor person and there's cholera in your water, screw you.
Well, no. One of the problems people have is they have a resentment towards private businesses providing the same services that a government would at a cheaper and better price.
How can explain this to me, Lawrence? If you want to privatize water supplies, and I know it's actually been done in a few places in the United States, and as far as I know, virtually everywhere it's been done, the price of water's gone up, the quality's gone down. How is it, in your opinion, that a private corporation where you've got CEOs who are making multi-million-dollar salaries, where you've got to skim off the top at least 5 or 10% a year to pay dividends to stockholders, where you've got marketing expenses and other expenses associated with being a private corporation, even if it's able to fire all the government employees who actually have pensions and decent benefits and are members of labor unions and do away with that whole middle-class thing, how can that company provide water at a cheaper price than government?
Well, you got me there. Not everything that the government does is going to be at a cheaper price. What you would get is a real price, an actual price for what it really costs to produce and trade any particular commodity or service. You know, the roads and bridges in this country are probably highly inflated in terms of their cost. A privatized roadway system would get the genuine price, what it actually would cost without government subsidies, without either special licenses that the government might give out or any other benefit, corporate benefits, whatever. All these things will be eliminated, and a company, let's say, that provides water, it would have to provide it based on the true cost of its production and nothing more.
But aren't there some things that we collectively, it sounds to me like you're just pitching the basic libertarian line that the purpose of government is just to provide for common defense and police and enforce contracts so businesses can do business and that's it, and leave everything else up to the so-called free marketplace.
Well, but the free market is us, the individuals, and the good.
No, that's not
about
true. If you and I are engaged in barter, that's true. But if you and I are using a dollar bill, then no, government's right in the middle of it because they
right.
create that currency, they define the value of that currency.
And
if you and I are entering into an agreement that's anything other than just a handshake, if we're entering into a contract, then you're asking for the government to participate in that in a huge way. You want there to be police to enforce it. You want there to be courts to adjudicate it. You want there to be jails in existence so that if you or I decide that the other has caused some harm or some fraud, the other can be put in prison. I mean, there is no such thing as a free marketplace. There's a government-created marketplace, Lawrence.
Well, there's a free market means that you and I have the freedom to make a decision to engage in some kind of voluntary activity, and the government will just, you know, give it, enforce it. But we're still free to have a contract or not, to decide the terms of it or not. The government really isn't. You know, when you talk about not a free market, it's when me and you want to get together and do something and the government steps in and says no. That's a violation of the free market, just because the government would enforce contracts.
No, what I'm submitting to you is that outside of barter between individuals, there's no such thing as a free market. It's an illusion made up by libertarians and conservatives.
Well, no, I mean, you could have, the government doesn't have to print currency. It actually shouldn't. The value of the U.S. dollar has dropped almost 90% over the last 100 years, and it's a tremendous.
So should we go back to the way it was between the failure of the Second American Bank in 1836 and the late 1880s when individual states and individual banks were coining money and we were every 5 or 6 years having a currency crisis and people were being wiped out?
Well, we have a currency crisis today. It's just slower. The main thing is the currency that we should have should be gold. Gold is like a natural currency. It comes from the ground. It's real. You can weigh it. You can measure it. And in a free market, you can expect and demand that your bank tell you exactly what their reserve requirements are for their bank. And you can.
Well, that's not a free market. That's a heavily government-regulated market. And you're asking, I'm assuming that you're asking that the government force the banks to do that.
No, the customers. You know, you get the. Let's say there's 10 banks in your town. We as customers could get together and say, hey, dear banks, tell us what your reserve requirements are. How do you operate? Show us the book.
But history indicates that customers aren't that sophisticated. I mean, you look at 200 and some odd years of American history, or look at over 1,000 years of European history, and what you find is that, you know, banks consistently, in the absence of government regulation, rip off their customers.
Well, a lot of times, think of Consumer Reports. They do a lot of testing for people, even though we can't buy every car and test it ourselves.
But what percentage of Americans do you think reads Consumer Reports? 1/100 of 1%?
Possibly. The main thing is that in a society where you're expected to be responsible for yourself, more types of these organizations would be out there so that you could.
So you're suggesting that I should be responsible for myself, you should be responsible for yourself, but nobody should be responsible for all of us.
I think the government should just protect our rights, and that's all.
Who's responsible for the guy down the street who was born with cystic fibrosis, has no family, and has no food?
Well, it depends. Whoever, he has to show some initiative, and maybe people will be compassionate towards him.
All he can do is go, ugh.
Well, it depends how he got that way. I mean, where did his parents come from? Where did, that he didn't just have.
So you do want the government involved in welfare decisions?
No, I don't. I, many people do compassionate act on their own without the government.
So we should just leave this up to private corporations and individuals. We should let the rich take care of it.
People also have churches. They have, you know, the number of people who are really in that position of cystic fibrosis is very small. And
well, it's one of a thousand ways people can become disabled. Somebody who has a spinal cord injury.
And people have insurance to protect them.
And cystic fibrosis. In fact, I had the disease wrong. Even I mean, I was thinking of something altogether. I was thinking of severe spina bifida. But in any case, okay. Well, it's an interesting concept.
Yep.
People can learn more about it at your website, which is free taxfreesociety.com. Lawrence Krauss, thanks for being with us. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
My kids don't read and my kids don't write. I'm stuck in a traffic jam every night. The crime rate's up, but that's all right, 'cause I got low taxes. Low taxes like they have in Mississippi. Low taxes, that's what I live for, low taxes. You bet your sweet Bippy, I hear those low taxes singing my song.
Indeed. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. See, what you were just hearing, this core libertarian idea is at the foundation of the conservative idea, which is that the United States is not a democratic republic, but rather, or shouldn't be, but should be reinvented essentially as an aristocracy. I mean, that's the bottom line. And that the aristocrats should be aristocrats by virtue of wealth, and the primary instrument for accumulating that wealth should be the corporation. For example, here we have, you know, recently a little strange news. I don't know, you know, quite how to define it other than strange news. Katie Couric is out going across the United States, and a group of reporters she's meeting with average Americans around America. She gets ready to do the CBS Evening News, right? And she wanted to talk to average Americans and a group of reporters. Now, Couric is a reporter, right? This is a six-city blitz of town meetings. Last one was Monday in San Francisco. And they asked the reporters to leave the room. Yep, this is all about reporting. See, reporters, you all leave. And people all over America are scratching their heads going, huh? I don't get it. Well, I get it. Let me tell you what this is about. The news is no longer about the news. The news, Katie Couric is being paid $15 million. Do you really, seriously, for even 30 seconds, think that CBS is going to pay her that kind of money because they want the news reported? They're paying her that kind of money because they want people to watch the program. News programs, just like, you know, frankly, all other kinds of programming nowadays, are one thing. They are vehicles to deliver commercials to listeners or viewers. Now, I'll be, you know, right up front about it. I mean, you know, this radio program, and I would say all radio programming, whether you're listening to country western music or whether you're listening to right-wing talk, left-wing talk, you know, whatever it may be, is supported by advertising. And, not, you know, frankly, I think that's a fine thing. It's an economic model. It works. But up until 87, and then, you know, finally 96, 87 when Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine, and 96 when Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act of 1996, up until then, most news operations actually lost money. Why would CBS have news bureaus all over the world? Why would they have reporters who were working to bring in the story? Why would they be doing investigative reporting and breaking open stories that otherwise wouldn't have been reported? Why were they exposing malfeasance and corruption and crime and boardrooms and government offices all across the United States? They were doing that because up until Reagan and Clinton, radio and television stations had to perform public service in order to maintain their license. Now, in order to keep your license, all you have to do is just make sure that somebody doesn't say seven words on the air, by and large. And so the news, because it's no longer mandated, it's no longer required that stations have to provide a community service of actually telling people what's going on in the world so that we can have an informed citizenry so we can have a functional democracy. The news institutions have become profit centers. And really, the CBS Evening News and all other news programs are produced in exactly the same way American Idol is produced, the exact same way that The Apprentice is produced, the exact same way Desperate Housewives is produced. A bunch of people sit in a room and say, okay, how do we get the most eyeballs to this program? Katie Couric is out doing her roadshow, not because she's trying to find out about the news. If she gave a damn about the news, Katie Couric would be in Lebanon right now. She'd be in Beirut. Or she'd be in Darfur. Or she'd be down in Mexico City reporting on what Lopez Obrador is doing. Or she would be in San Francisco reporting on how instant runoff voting works. I mean, she cared at all about the news. She'd be in Ohio right now reporting on what Ken Blackwell is up to. She'd be in San Diego talking about the Busbee-Bilray election. No, it's not about the news. It's about how do you get and keep viewers so that you can deliver them to advertisers who will pay a good, you know, fee so that you can make a profit, so that you can pay the $15 million that Katie Couric is asking for. And I'm not saying that that makes CBS evil or bad, or frankly that their news is going to be any better or worse than anybody else's. It's just, in my opinion, not a healthy thing for democracy. In my opinion, for democracy to work, we need to have actual news. Most other countries in the world got this, and they have the equivalent of what the British have with the BBC, state-funded news, where there is a clear firewall between the funding institution and the news itself, although during the Blair administration they've been trying to break that down so that the government can have some control over what the BBC reports. But prior to the Blair administration, following the Bush administration's lead with the Corporation for Republican Broadcasting here in the United States, prior to that, PBS, CBC, BBC, they were the news. 27 minutes past.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. By the way, we give you a new way to sound off about an issue or topic of the day, our comment line. Just pick up the phone and call 503-323-6620. The number's, by the way, on our homepage at tomhartman.com. You can find it. Scroll down the page a little ways. You'll see it. 503-323-6620. Give us your take in 30 seconds or less, because we want to hear from you. 503-323-6620. Remember, your thoughts and opinions may just make it on the air, so make it count, 503-323-6620. Another public service from the Tom Hartman radio program. You're talking about privatization and the whole conservative worldview. I mean, just this whole absolutely incredibly tragic, bizarre conservative worldview and what it's doing to America. Broadly speaking, what it's doing to America. Yeah, that's what it's doing to America. It's moving an awful lot of our cash over to China, for example. Roads and bridges, this is the Associated Press, roads and bridges built by U.S. taxpayers are offshore alert music, by the way. I actually love this music. Roads and bridges built by U.S. taxpayers are starting to be sold off and so far foreign-owned companies are doing the buying. Now, why would that be? Could have something to do with the fact that we buy about $800 billion a year more from the rest of the world in junk to sell at Walmart than they buy from us, and so they've got all this money that they're sitting on, all these U.S. dollars. They got to figure out a way to spend them inside the United States. So what are they doing? They're buying our roads and bridges. On a single day in June, an Australian-Spanish partnership paid $3.8 billion to lease an Indiana toll road. An Australian company bought a 99-year lease on Virginia's Pocahontas Parkway. And Texas officials decided to let a Spanish-American partnership build and run a toll road from Austin to Seguin for 50 years. People know that the tolls from the U.S. side of the tunnel between Detroit and Windsor, Canada, go to an Australian company, which also owns a bridge in Alabama. In Chicago last year, the city sold a 99-year lease on the 8-mile Chicago Skyway for $1.83 billion. The buyer, a Marquet Infrastructure Group of Sydney, Australia, and Sintra Concesiones de Infraestructuras de Transporte of Madrid, Spain. In Orange County, California, well, they got burned. They sold a tow road, the road part of State Route 91, built and run for $130 by the California Private Transportation Company, partly owned by a French-based company, Compagnie Française et Industrielle de l'Autoroute. The road opened in 1995. 7 years later, Orange County bought it back. Why? Because the lease said that they couldn't build more roads. The road was over capacity, and they were looking at gridlock. So they bought back the lease for $207.5 million. But, you know, I mean, this is just... just the beginning of the whole thing. I mean, it's just Rick Perry wants to attract more than $80 billion in private funds for roads in Texas. He wants to sell off the road from Oklahoma to Mexico and the Gulf Coast, one from Shreveport, Louisiana, and Texarkana to Mexico. A company named Sintra Zachary is cutting a $7.2 billion. Actually, last year they did it with Texas Governor Rick Perry. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. We're selling off our core infrastructure here in the United States. This is the Associated Press from yesterday's paper. In Alabama, on December 30th, 2005, a subsidiary of Australian-based Macquarie Infrastructure Group brought the Foley Beach Expressway for $95 million, Orange Beach and Baldwin County. In California, construction began on Route 125, four-lane, 9.5-mile toll road east of San Diego, owned by Macquarie. $400 million they paid for it. Illinois, January 25th, the city of Chicago. Well, I already told you about that one. Indiana, June 29th. I think I just told you about that one. Macquarie Sintra again, 75-year lease, 157-mile Indiana toll road. Michigan, in January 2001, Macquarie North America Infrastructure, subsidiary of their Global Infrastructure Fund, bought the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel. In Virginia, Macquarie paid $533 million to buy 86.7% ownership in the 14-mile Dulles Greenway and is negotiating for the rest. This is the road that goes out to Dulles International Airport. On June 29th, Melbourne, Australia-based Transurban paid $519 million for a 99-year lease on the 8.8-mile Pocahontas Parkway, which connects the Richmond Airport with highways south of the city. In Alaska, backers of the Nick Arm Bridge say they will look to private funding for the $600 million bridge to connect Anchorage to Point McKenzie. In Colorado, the Front Range Toll Road Company proposes a 210-mile corridor from Wellington to just south of Pueblo. It's called the Super Slab. And in Florida, the Tampa Hillsborough Expressway Authority is looking for private investors to build a 3.1-mile toll road to connect I-275 to Central Tampa, $150 million. In Illinois, privatization of the 274-mile Illinois Tollway is being studied right now by the Illinois legislature. In Indiana, Governor Mitch Daniels wants a private company to help build a $1.8 billion 142-mile extension of I-69. And manage it as a tollway. It's going on in Missouri. There's a $910 million bridge. In Nevada, Boulder City just signed a study to build a toll road between the junction of I-93 and 995 and the Hoover Dam bypass. In New Jersey, they're looking at selling off 173 miles of the Garden State Parkway, 148 miles of the New Jersey Turnpike to private investors. In New York, they want to privatize the Long Island Expressway and the Tappan Zee Bridge. In Ohio, the Republicans are talking, Ken Blackwell, he's talking about leasing the 241-mile Ohio Turnpike. In Oregon, Oregon is looking at an 11-mile bypass. In Texas, well, I told you about the Texas ones. It just goes on and on and on. It's all about taking that, the public good, the public wealth, the commonwealth, the stuff that we share in common, and turning it over to private for-profit corporations so that somebody who's contributing campaign money to somebody else can make a buck on it. And who ends up, you know, over the short term? Gee, it looks like a great deal. Over the short term, hey, it's a state that doesn't have much money, that's having real problems because they've got a bunch of cons in there, have passed things like Tabor, the so-called Taxpayer Bill of Rights, that makes it harder for the government to actually operate, or is having to deal with No Child Left Behind, where now by government mandate they have to buy tests from Neil Bush's company that sells private, for-profit, you know, $25 student tests when you could, you know, it used to be in the old days the teacher would run it off on the Mimeo machine and it would cost a penny and a half. You know, these states, municipalities, counties, they're all being screwed by these conservatives. And there's such a sentiment against raising taxes that it's like, well, hey, we can make a quick $6 billion. All we have to do is sell off the roads. And then 5-10 years down the road, down the line, you go, you know, we no longer own the road. And they just raised the price to drive on it from $10 to $20, and we can't do anything about it. I mean, there is a reason why we have public utilities. There's a reason why there are some things that are actually better owned by the public. Now, maybe privatizing all of our roads is a good idea. But if we're going to do that, I would say that what we should do is, like virtually all the countries in Europe, we should publicize our railroads. Let's start replacing our private transportation infrastructure with a public transportation infrastructure. After all, the roads are being used by private cars, so, yeah, sell them off to private corporations. Now, I tell you, most of these states and municipalities and counties that are selling these roads are getting screwed. They're getting, the only reason a company would buy it is because they know they can make money on it. I mean, if you consider the cost of building a new road right now, they'll say, well, you know, it's only 35 acres of dirt underneath that, you know, 80-mile road. 35 acres of dirt, that's not worth anything. Well, if you were to build that from scratch, think of all the houses that you'd have to go through, all the homeowners that you'd have to go through with eminent domain and say, you know, we're going to take your house out. We're going to have to pay you off for that. All the political grief that you went, that had been gone through to build that. But in any case, if we're going to privatize our streets, which I think is a terrible idea, at least let's build a good, strong public transportation infrastructure. But no, the cons don't want to do that either. Because the cons want all of your and my ability to transport ourselves anywhere to be in the hands of private for-profit corporations. And not just private for-profit corporations that want our money. They also want to sell us these little passes that you put in your car where when you go through it automatically keeps track of you so that it automatically bills you. But it also automatically keeps track of where you went, where you are, who you are, what you're doing there. GPS in your phones, chips in your clothes. And it is not the Big Brother that we thought it was going to be. It's not the George Orwell, gee, it's the government coming to get us, Big Brother. No, it is the corporate Big Brother. It is the major corporate Big Brother coming to get us. And, you know, so at some point you have to say, you know, I just am not sure this is such a good idea. I just don't. Medicare. The Bush administration has privatized part of Medicare. They did a no-bid contract. I'd like to know whose relative, you know, what, Tom DeLay's wife or somebody, whose relative is working with 3M Corporation that they got a sole source contract, 3M Health Information Systems, to do the Medicare computing. And as a result of this, they want to cut back. If you're going to get a stent, they're going to cut 33% off the payments to the hospitals. You want a defibrillator like Dick Cheney? 23% cut. You want a new hip or knee? 10% cut. Why? Because the cons are privatizing chunks of Medicare. Ain't it wonderful? 45 minutes past the hour.
7-5.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, I've got those blues.
Republican blues. Well, I'm a patriot, and that's the fact, but something's wrong with the way that Congress acts. I'm there if it's worth fighting for, but I don't want to fight for curious George Bush and his friends. Sold us this war till they get those oil fields. They're gonna sell us some more. Well, Katrina came, Katrina went. The money we need has all been spent. New Orleans and Baghdad, it's all the same. And the contracts are written in Halliburton's name. It's the same old blues, Republican blues.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves, a very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And welcome back. 51 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com, the website for the latest iPods and all things Macintosh and all things related. As I was sharing with you, the cons are at it. They want to sell off America to the highest bidder. We're going to end up with an absolute corporate aristocracy ruling every aspect of our lives. Of course, our health care now ruled by corporate powers, our banking ability ruled by corporate powers, our the ability to get credit, you know, on it goes. And they want to make sure that every aspect of America is owned and ruled by corporate power. Dan Quayle, by the way, it was a John Mellencamp concert, was that? John Cougar Mellencamp. He dedicated a song to all the people hurt by the Bush administration economic policies. Dan Quayle was in the audience. He gets up and walks out. Oh, Dan, you know, life is tough for millionaires from Indiana. Jim in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Our number, by the way, 866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, you go to tomhartman.com, click live chat. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Well, Tom, let me say, first of all, I want to say thanks to you and Louise for having this common sense, factual program on the air. My goodness, it's so good to hear somebody actually telling the real news. Now,
thank you, Jim.
That rant about them selling off our infrastructure, I am just totally bowled over and amazed that our own government is selling out our sovereignty. I'm just amazed.
Well, they're doing it because Grover Norquist has been successful. Back in 2002 when he told Mara Liasson, he said, we don't want to destroy American government. We just want to shrink it down to the point where we can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub. They've pretty much done that now. Bush has thrown us so deeply into debt. And just the interest on the national debt is $170 billion a year. I mean, that's a mind-boggling amount of money. That's enough money to hire enough teachers that no classroom in America would have to have more than 10 students in it. And, I mean, that's just the interest on the debt. And so we're in such a terrible situation right now as a result of Bush economic policies and Reagan economic policies before that, and frankly, Clinton economic policies, at least with regard to international trade, that states and municipalities are having to sell stuff off.
Yeah, I understand.
So anyhow, yeah, I interrupted you, Jim. You were going someplace with that thought, I'm assuming. Nope, I guess not. Okay, Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for taking good morning.
Good morning.
You're exactly right. We've talked about it so much, I probably sound ad nauseum. Yeah, too much wealth does undermine democracy. And that's continued to be, I think, the bottom line. And obviously, our priorities with money for America is in the toilet because of the cons.
Yeah,
isn't that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically? that's absolutely what I'm saying, Gary. And thank you for calling and re-saying it. Now, we just have a minute or so left, and I want to just leave you with this, at least in this first hour of this 3-hour program. I just want to leave you with this final thought. Newt Gingrich, talking to insiders last week, Republican insiders, said if Republicans are going to win in 2006 and 2008. Republicans have to characterize what's going on in the Middle East as World War III. And so then yesterday, he goes on Meet the Press, because, you know, if you can cause people to think you're in a war, then you can scare them enough that a Republican demagogue like Bush can get them. So then yesterday he goes on Meet the Press.
destroy the tunnels of New York. We're in the early stages of what I would describe as the Third World War, and frankly, our bureaucracies aren't responding fast enough, and we don't have the right attitude about this. And this is the 58th year of the war to destroy Israel, and frankly, the Israelis have every right to insist that every single missile leave South Lebanon, and that the United States ought to be helping the Lebanese government have the strength to eliminate Hezbollah as a military force, not as a political force in the parliament, but as a military force in South Lebanon.
This is World War III.
I believe if you take all the countries I just listed that you've been covering, put them on a map, look at all the different connectivity, you'd have to say to yourself, this is, in fact, World War III.
And that's Newt Gingrich on Meet the Press saying, we're in World War III, just a day or so after he told a group of Republicans, if you want to win in 2006, we have to make sure that there is a war and that everybody knows there's a war and the war meme is out there and, you know, everybody thinks of Iraq now as an occupation, not a war. I mean, I'm not quoting him. I'm paraphrasing his concept. Everybody thinks of Iraq as an occupation, not a war. We need a war. Judy in Dana Point, California. Hey, Judy, we just have a half a minute left or so. What's up?
Well, I just have a concern. If they do the job they did in New Orleans by helping the people, how in the hell are they going? Oh, excuse me, I didn't mean to say hell.
That's okay.
Help the people get 25,000 Americans out of Lebanon. I mean, their record is very poor, and it's a very big concern of mine.
Yeah, well, you know, they did a very, very good job in Florida the year before with Hurricane Charley. They had you know, tens of thousands of pounds of ice there in advance. People were getting checks within 5 days after the hurricane. They know how to do this stuff. It's just that they decided, in my opinion, they decided to stick it to the people in New Orleans. They turned a blue state red is what they did.
I guess. I don't know. I still consider. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Judy. I think one of the mistakes that we make is to think that these guys are incompetent. They're not incompetent. They're running things exactly the way that they want them run. They want us to think that government can't do anything right so that they can sit around and say, see, government can't do anything right. Let's do away with it. Let's turn it all over to Halliburton. And, you know, that's the ultimate plan. Let's privatize everything. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, podcasting on Apple iTunes, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, streaming out of Air America Radio at airamericaradio.com and airamerica.com as well. Either one will get you there. Welcome back to our program in 50 and in 29 states on cable systems on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. Back in November of 2004, I do a monthly book review, you know, plug a book of the month for BuzzFlash. And back in November of 2004, my book of the month was actually a combination book and DVD, Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate, and How Democrats and Progressives Can Win by George Lakoff. It was brilliant. It still is. It's still there. In fact, you can still go over to BuzzFlash and get it or the bookstore near you or online or whatever you prefer. George Lakoff has a new book out. It's called Whose Freedom? The Battle Over America's Most Important Idea. George Lakoff, professor of cognitive science and linguistics at UC Berkeley. George Lakoff, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom, and especially with you. I'm a fan.
Well, thank you, and vice versa entirely. The table of contents of your book seems like just a great place to start. In going through the, I've only had the book for a couple of days. Sometimes you get these things just before an interview, and have not had an opportunity to literally, you know, read it word for word all the way through. But I've spent a fair amount of time with it, and it seems like this is as good an outline as possible because. What I'd like to do is just go through each one of these steps in the 7 or 8 minutes that we have here and just ask you for your summaries of what this means. You start out with freedom is freedom. You know, what freedom is visceral. Why is it that Bush uses the word freedom instead of democracy? What does freedom mean to Americans and why is that important?
Freedom is the central concept in American political life. and the right is taking it over. What's interesting about it is it's a contested concept. A contested concept is something like art, where people necessarily have different understandings of what the concept means based on their values. Most people think that, there's just one meaning of freedom, that, you know, freedom is freedom is freedom, there's one thing. But it's not true. There is, however, an uncontested core we all agree on, and the big part of the first part of the book is that. And it is visceral. It has to do with, it's based on physical freedom. When you're tied up or you're kept from moving or kept from going where you want to go or you're put in a cell and you can't get out or what, you know, you feel incredibly frustrated. It's in your body. And when you project that to, the inability to achieve your goals, to problems of political freedom, of free will, and various impositions on your freedom, you get incredibly frustrated. That's why it's such an important idea. What Bush does is take advantage of the core meaning of freedom that everybody agrees on, and then he extends it to a new conservative meaning of freedom that applies in every area of life, and that goes against the traditional progressive idea of freedom.
Now, back in July of 1936, when Franklin Roosevelt accepted his party's nomination, and you know, I think it was in Philadelphia for a second term as President of the United States, he, in his acceptance speech, quoted an old English judge in saying, a necessitous man is not a free man. In other words, it was an early statement of what Abraham Maslow wrote in 1972 when he defined his hierarchy of human needs. Actually, it might have been before that, but in any case, what Maslow wrote about that if you're hungry, you're not free. If you're cold, you're not free. If you don't know where you're going to sleep tonight, if you don't have clothes, you're not free. I mean, and yet. And there was a consensus in America that a necessitous man, a person whose foundational necessities for safety and security are not satisfied, was not free. That was something that all Americans understood from the time of the Great Depression, and I would say from long before that, frankly, but certainly from the time of the Great Depression until Ronald Reagan became president. And then things changed. This fundamental paradigm changed, and the conservatives have succeeded in redefining freedom as you're free if you have low taxes and you can do anything in the marketplace without the government telling you to, and freedom has nothing to do with whether or not you're hungry.
That's exactly right. And what I do in the book is show that this is that's completely systematic, that it comes out of a conservative worldview, and that it applies in many areas. It's certainly true about economics and about being hungry and poor. It also applies in a very strange way to religion. When religious liberty is invoked, what's meant is that if they take freedom of religion to mean freedom to practice your religion, and if you're an evangelical, practicing means spreading the good news, and if you're a fundamentalist, it means the Bible is true. So you're supposed to be spreading the good news about the truth of the Bible, and freedom of speech is guaranteed by the government to do that, and they interpret that as the government guarantees the right to proselytize. A very interesting version of this in conservative populism. People wonder about why it is that many poor conservatives and lower middle class conservatives vote against their economic self-interest. And the reason is that they have a conservative worldview about many things, in particular family life and family values, and what I call a strict father worldview. And the conservatives have their message machine has convinced people that they're being oppressed by liberals. So they speak of liberty all the time. Liberty is freedom from a political oppression by an elite. And the
but that's the core
they
of liberal
see that
idea
as the liberal
enlightened.
Elite. The liberal elite is oppressing conservatives. And they mean that, and the book goes through exactly why the liberal elite is imposing on the freedom of poor conservatives, and exactly what that means, and what it means to them. There's another wild thing that, you know, came out of the book, which is a real understanding of the foreign policy involved and why Bush can go to Iraq as it is now and say he's visiting a free country. And the reason is that they have a view of free market freedom. That is, if you have laissez-faire free markets and impose it on a country, the assumption is then that democracy will automatically follow. And the reason it will automatically follow is pretty wild. It says, if you do this, a bunch of people will get rich. They'll want to protect their property. They'll be influential. So they'll insist on free elections, which they can contribute to and help to control. Then to protect their property, they'll insist on balance of powers, because a dictatorial president could take it away. And then to avoid military coups, they'll insist on civilian control of the military. And to avoid being thrown in jail and having their property taken away, they'll insist on civil liberties. And the idea is that simply by imposing free market freedom and getting a class of rich people, democracy will automatically follow, which is kind of nuts.
Well, the way you just described it, it actually kind of sounds like it makes sense. I mean, why is it kind of – you and I both know that what really they're talking about is imposing Victorian-era economics, you know, taking us back to the world of Scrooge and Marley and Bob Cratchit. But how is it nuts?
It's nuts. I mean, take a look at Singapore. You know, that's hardly your model of a democracy. You know, China is getting, free markets. It's not doing anything like this. Saudi Arabia is not your idea of a free country. You know, just think about it for a minute. It doesn't quite work that way.
Right. So, in other words, if you impose laissez-faire economics and a wealthy class emerges, what you're far more likely to end up with than democracy is autocracy of some form.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or oligarchy.
An oligarchy.
Yeah.
And, but that's the theory. And it's a pretty nutty theory. But it's the basis of our foreign policy. And
how do we take, we just have 30, 40 seconds left here, George Lakoff, how do we take America back to FDR's notion of a necessitous man is not a free man?
We need to be talking about progressive freedom, which is traditional American freedom. And you can see that, you know, in the way we have insisted over time that freedoms be expanded, both freedoms of access to capital, freedom from want, freedom from fear, but also, freedom to vote. Voting rights have been expanded. Civil rights have been expanded. The right to an education has been expanded. These are the things that our people in our country have insisted on. They are progressive freedoms, and we've insisted on expanding progressive freedom. And we need to remember exactly why we say that this is a free country.
Well said. GeorgeLakoff.com, the website, the new book, Whose Freedom? The Battle Over America's Most Important Idea. Go ahead.
Rockridgeinstitute.org
as well. .com.
Okay. No, .org.
Right. .org. Okay, you got it. George Lakoff, thanks for being with us. 16 minutes.
Bye-bye.
16 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our number toll free across the United States, to drop into our live chat room at TomHartmann.com. Here's the guy. They should figure out a way. I don't know. Where you get pheromones from sweat? They should figure out a way, maybe a blood transplant, some kind of transfusion. I don't know. But somehow, before November 2004, Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador should have given some kind of transplant of something to John Kerry, because he got 900,000 people standing in the square in Mexico City yesterday. Mexico, a yellow revolution brewing? Yes, yellow. They have logoized this thing. They've got a color. They're nailing this thing down. For hours, the world's second biggest square after Tiananmen in Beijing was colored with yellow, the color of López Obrador's Democratic Revolution Party. Actually, some of the best coverage of this, oddly enough, from AlJazeera.net. The reporter Dima Khatib, the Al Jazeera correspondent in Mexico, says, I recently visited one of Mexico City's many poor neighborhoods. Everywhere I went, I could smell the sewage. I'll tell you, I've been there. I can testify. Anyhow, people here earn less than $2 a day. Of course, compared to other countries I've been to, it's not that bad. However, this is Mexico, where there should not be any poverty at all. The country's rich in resources, including oil, gas, and uranium, but has one of Latin America's worst records on wealth distribution. And therein lies the rub. As you see in today's Wall Street Journal, an article by Jose de Cordoba and John Lyons, populist president candidate Andres Manuel López Obrador ratcheted up pressure on the country's election authorities by calling on hundreds of thousands of Mexicans in the capital's central square to engage in a campaign of peaceful civil disobedience. Oh, man. You know, whatever this guy has got, we need to take, not just John Kerry, we need to get a whole long list, Democratic candidate. We need to get these guys down to Mexico and hook them up to, you know, some kind of machine that Dr. Frankenstein made. How do you transplant this? I don't know. Maybe just seeing the example will be enough. I mean, right here in our hemisphere. Mr. Obrador is in a legal and political battle with the election's first-place finisher, Felipe Calderon. The country's seven-person electoral court, known as the TRIFE, has until the end of August to rule on Mr. López Obrador's demands for a full recount. They have a number of options. They can have a partial recount. They can annul the election, in which case you'd have new elections in 18 months. They can name an interim president, or they can simply say, hey, Calderon won. Get over it. Mr. Calderon, working toward that, he said, Mr. Calderon has been working to assemble a majority coalition in Congress to give the appearance that he's already governing. But here's a quote from, you know, the man in the street, right? The man in the street quote here in today's Wall Street Journal. A fraud has been committed, and we must defend our vote, said Miguel Perez, a 44-year-old special education teacher from the state of Veracruz, carrying a coffin labeled Democracy. Many people in the square pledged to continue with protests, even if the electoral court ruled against Mr. López Obrador. People are mobilized, said Linda Esparza, a psychology student. People are mobilized. The mobilizations will continue. Since the election, Mr. López Obrador has kept up a campaign to overturn election results by leaking videotapes and documents purporting to show fraud and attacking the reputation of Mexico's respected electoral authorities. Yeah, respected elected authorities? Wow. I'm amazed I read that in the Wall Street Journal. It was 8 years ago that the Mexican election was widely acknowledged to have been stolen? The progressive candidate was ahead, and so all of a sudden the government just shut down the computers and says, oops, we got a computer problem here. 7 or 8 hours later, they turned them back on. Oh, gee, look at that. Now Vicente Fox is ahead. I don't think there's any people who would argue that election wasn't stolen. Anyhow, they say since the election, he's kept up a campaign to overturn election results by leaking videotapes and documents purporting to show fraud and attacking the reputation of Mexico's respected electoral authorities. But according to the Beltran poll, 61% of respondents said they didn't believe the evidence provided by Mr. López Obrador proved his fraud allegations. Greg Palast has been reporting from Mexico on this thing, suggesting that the exit polls, right up until the very last minute, just like in the United States in 2000 and 2002 and 2004, and the exit polls were showing that the progressive was winning. And then all of a sudden, at the very last minute, they changed. Sort of like in the Ukraine. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Take back your offshore drilling machine. We'd rather keep our water clean. And you have lied too many times. Our children will pay for your crimes. Said you were gonna utilize it, but all you've ever really done is brutalize it.
We've learned something from the hell you've put us through. It ain't up to you. It ain't up to you, Big Oil. Why you've chased your endless greed. We have watched our planet bleed.
And it ain't up to you, Big Oil. Welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. George W. Bush at the G8 Summit. Pretty much wrapping up now. Here he, Vlad Putin takes a shot at him. Bush talking about the wonders of democracy in Iraq, freedom in Iraq, yes. And Putin says, don't think we want that kind of freedom here. Thank you very much. Here it is.
I talked about my desire to promote institutional change in parts of the world, like Iraq, where there's a free press and free religion. And I told him that a lot of people in our country, you know, would hope that Russia would do the same thing. I fully understand, however, that there will be a Russian-style democracy.
And then Putin responds.
We certainly would not want to have the same kind of democracy as they have in Iraq.
We certainly would not want to have the same kind of democracy as they have in Iraq. And Bush says, just you wait.
Quite honestly.
Just wait.
Yeah, just wait. Just wait for what? Democracy in Iraq? Or for something to happen in Russia? I mean, it's all getting very, very spooky. Here's Bill Kristol. Juan Williams is on Bill Kristol on Fox News this weekend. And Juan Williams says to Bill Kristol, this is actually Juan Williams. He's sitting next to Bill Kristol. Bill Kristol being the, you know, one of the neocon philosopher kings. One of the guys who said, yeah, all you need to do is just take out Iraq and everything will be fine, right? It'll reorder the Middle East. It'll reorganize the Middle East. Here's Juan Williams.
So you just want war, 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 and you want us in more war. You wanted us in Iraq. Now you wanted us in Iran. Now you want us to get into the Middle East. Where has it gotten us, Bill?
Yeah. And so then, you know, Condi Rice, George Stephanopoulos, the question comes up, could it be that the regional instability, you know, that the reason why Hezbollah and Hamas are behaving the way they are is in part because there's so much instability in the region as a consequence of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Oh, Condi. Oh, good heavens. She's so upset about this, she's going to have to go out and buy a new couple of pair of shoes here.
How do you answer administration critics who say that the administration's actions have helped unleash the very hostilities you hope to contain?
Well, first of all, those hostilities were not very well contained, as we found out on September 11th. And so the notion that somehow policies that finally confront extremism are actually causing extremism, I find grotesque.
In other words, whenever anybody challenges the Bush administration on the insane foreign policies that they're pursuing, simply mention 9/11 and all will be well, right? I mean, that's the simple answer. Just mention 9/11. Yeah. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. We've covered a lot of territory here. Robert in Butler, Pennsylvania. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today? No Robert.
Hello?
Hey, Robert.
Hello? Oh, I didn't hear. I got a blank spot right after my first name. I thought,
okay.
Oh, maybe there's two Roberts.
You are live on the air.
No, okay. Yeah, the guy that was interviewed, like man on the street kind of thing, down in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't catch his name, but they said it on the air, and he was a teacher with at-risk children or something like that.
Yeah, Miguel Perez, 44-year-old special ed teacher. This is in the Wall Street Journal, by the way, the conservative newspaper.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it'd be an interesting thing if we could get a hold of him and tell him to have some friends call somebody up here like you or whatever, if he happens to disappear, because, you know, people have a habit of doing that down there and increasingly here.
When they speak out against the government, you mean?
Yeah.
It tragically, we, you know, Mexico is really more an oligarchy than a democracy. In the United States, Bush certainly wants to move us in that direction, Robert.
Absolutely. And it'd be an interesting just to see generally how the Mexican government handles this this request for a recount.
Yeah.
Total recount.
Yeah, it is going to be really interesting to watch, and it's particularly going to be interesting to see how this thing plays out with Lopez Obrador. In particular, because Lopez Obrador did not, this wasn't two candidates. You know, neither one of these guys got, I don't think either one of them got even over 40% of the vote, because there were multiple candidates in this race. And so some 60% of voters did not vote for Lopez Obrador. And he's, in fact, they point this out in the Wall Street Journal. He had 37% of the vote. His opponent had like 37.5% of the vote. So, you know, he's risking alienating all his other folks as well. And we'll see how it shakes out. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. When you're talking about the privatization roads, you mentioned the thing of these quick passes that you can drive through a toll terminal that keep track of you.
Yeah.
Two things. Even without that, they're still filming you when you go through the toll booth. So
that's right. They grab your license plate.
Yeah, so they're already keeping track of you. But right now there's a very insidious thing that's happening that we can all start rejecting immediately. Is a lot of credit cards are being replaced now with credit cards with RFID chips in there, the quick swipe ones where you don't.
Yeah, I think they call it one of the gas companies calls them an easy pass or something like that.
Yeah, and you can reject those and keep a normal card.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to do that. I mean, everybody needs to do that immediately and really tell the companies we don't want these.
Yeah,
You've had the guest on there before from spychips.com, and I think you should mention that website every month. People should really pay attention to that.
Yeah, spychips.com. Yeah, and in fact, for those who haven't heard what Jeff is talking about, and the reason why this is a concern is because these radio frequency identification chips, RFID chips, really what they are is transponders. You interrogate them electronically, and even though they don't have a battery in them, they have a particular signature that is noticed by the interrogating signal. And so if you have one of these chips in, say, a credit card in your wallet, and you happen to be standing in a crowd of demonstrators, say, outside the Republican National Convention, and somebody just goes by with a scanner in their hand, boom, they've got all your personal information. They've got your credit card number. They've got your address. They've got everything. They've got everything on you. And the U.S. government is going to be putting these in our passports starting in the next few months. And the Real ID Act requires all states within the next 2 years to put them in our driver's licenses.
And they require the Real ID Act also requires that they're readable from a certain distance, I believe. So it's like as you drive by,
right.
Even if you're in your car, they can tell you're going by.
Yeah, we are entering into an era of Big Brother that's huge, and where the Bushies have really been making the most of this is, I mean, there are a lot of laws to protect the government from invading our privacy, and so all they do is they hire private companies to do it for them. Choice Point, for example, right at the top of the list.
And we can nip this in the bud right now. And
I think the bud is gone. I think we got a whole tree here growing, Jeff.
Well, we still got to keep doing things.
I agree. Thanks a lot for the call. Where do you go with this? It's the situation in the Middle East continuing. Catch the news for the kind of blow-by-blow. Olmert in Israel is now gaining in popularity. At the same time, Hamas or Hezbollah, rather, in southern Lebanon gaining in popularity. I mean, this is the kind of thing where polarization and war seems to help everybody except the civilians. Everybody except, you know, the average person. And the average person is who, you know, gets stuck out on, you know, out on a limb. There is this notion, which I put out in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? And you find it actually in oddly enough, in some of the neocon books, but it's also, you know, just kind of broadly accepted, that democracies don't attack democracies. And yet here we have the democracy of Israel arguably attacking the democracy of Lebanon. Or you could flip that around and you could say that the democracy of Lebanon started out by attacking the democracy of Israel, you know, by crossing into Israeli territory and taking these two soldiers. And really, if the United States, if the Bush administration 3 years ago, when the United Nations passed Resolution 1559, and Israel said, okay, we're going to get out of southern Lebanon, in exchange for that, and the UN was behind this, and in exchange for that, the army of Lebanon has to come into southern Lebanon and demilitarize that area. disarm Hezbollah. If that had happened, this wouldn't be going on right now. And the Bush administration could have facilitated that. In fact, should have facilitated, should have helped make that happen. But instead, Hezbollah has gotten stronger and stronger. The Lebanese democracy is fairly weak and fragile. Hezbollah has two parts to it. There's the military part, which is operating in the south and attacking Israel and now in a war with Israel. And then there's the political part that is participating in the government. It's sort of like the schizophrenia of the Irish Republican Army 30 years ago when they were first starting, having an internal debate about, are we going to be political or are we going to be military? And they ultimately decided to be political. And it's just one of those very, very, very messy situations. And I'm very wary of anybody who tries to boil this down into a soundbite. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
For the safety of our homeland, I think we've been through this before. Sent our kids to die in Vietnam to keep the commies from our door. Now they tell us there's a way to live. Mixed messages are clear. Spend your breath and watch your back. Oh, live your life in fear. If I told you once, must have told you twice. The last thing you're looking for is their advice.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour in the real free speech zone, the Tom Hartman radio program. If I, by the way, Louise beat me here during the break, said, did you say that Lebanon invaded Israel and took us in? If I did say that, I meant Hezbollah. So my apologies. Victoria Jones, our deserted White House senior correspondent with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. It's just nice to talk to a human being.
Yeah, because there's none of them there in the White House?
Nobody's here. I mean, there's one woman from CNN, there's a person from Fox, and there's me, and that's it. Not even the cameramen, the sound men. There's nobody here.
Holy cow. Well, what are you guys doing there?
I break into
the liquor cabinet, right?
I have a great work ethic.
I see. Okay. So what's news?
Well, Bush's expletive, which, by the way, was just played on CNN. They just played it as an expletive.
Oh, really?
And it's yes. Yep.
On TV?
Yep, they played the whole thing on TV, which I thought was a very interesting decision that they came to. That is being made into news in and of itself. It actually is interesting because I think it tells us exactly where he and Blair are, far more than any of the public statements.
Well, I think it also helps Bush. I mean, that's the kind of thing that Bush's people would want people to hear because it makes him sound like he's a tough-talking guy. It makes him sound like he's an average guy. And it also suggests that he thinks that if they could... Now, here's the part that probably most, people who drill a level deeper don't get. Basically, what he said was, why don't they just get Syria to stop Hezbollah from doing this? And that means that Bush believes that Hezbollah is operating pure and simple at the behest of, was it Syria or Iran?
Well, he says Syria in the quote, but we know that, people suspect that Iran is involved.
Yeah. So that means that he thinks that this is really Syria pulling the strings. And I don't for a minute think that this is Syria pulling the strings. I think that this is a battle within Hezbollah for the control of Hezbollah, whether it's going to be a political or a military institution in Lebanon, and that it is the simple failure of the Bush administration and other governments around the world, but in particular the Bush administration, because we play a leadership role in this over the last, 4 or 5 years or so, 3 years since UN Resolution 1559 and Israel pulling out of southern Lebanon to fill that vacuum. And Hezbollah filled the vacuum instead.
That's fascinating. Of course, nothing along the lines of what you just said is being aired anywhere.
Well, you look at what happened with the Irish Republican Army. And there was a time, you know, when the Irish Republican Army was entirely a resistance movement, an armed resistance movement. And I visited Northern Ireland during that time. It was a scary time. And you talk to one family on, you know, in one block, and you know, they literally are talking about killing the family two blocks down. I mean, people, everybody knew somebody who had died. And over time, there was this schism that emerged in the IRA, and a political arm, you know, Sinn Féin came out of this thing, and the political arm said, hey, you know, we're going to make a whole lot more hay politically than we are militarily, and there is, you know, Hezbollah has members in parliament in Lebanon. I mean, there are groups, people within Hezbollah who are trying to turn it, at least this is my understanding. I'm not speaking from firsthand knowledge, but my understanding is there are people in Hezbollah who are trying to turn it into a part of a democratic institution, into a political institution. And then, of course, there's the old, you know, hardliners who are, you know, destroy Israel no matter what kind of, you know, whatever, or basically using that to gain power. And by attacking Israel and getting Israel to respond the way that they did, the hardliners are gaining power and the moderates are losing power.
That's very interesting.
And the hardliners, to the extent that they're associated with Syria or for that matter, Iran. I mean, you know, keep in mind, Hezbollah is Shia, and Syria, I believe, is Sunni, isn't it?
I believe it is. Yeah, and Iran is Shia.
Yeah, and Iran is Shia, and Hamas is Sunni. So, I think maybe the associations, Hezbollah would be more likely associated with Iran in all probability, just if those kinds of cleavages are happening. But you know, frankly, you know, my take on this is that this is a battle inside. I mean, you have it. We know that there's a battle going on inside Hamas in the Palestinian territories over what the nature of Hamas is going to be. Are they going to be part of a government in the future? Are they going to be political? Or are they going to continue to be an armed, you know, rebel group, you know, fighting against the existence of Israel, et cetera? And I think that the same thing is going on with Hezbollah. And you can argue whether the response of Israel is strengthening them or weakening them. And I could argue either side of that, you know, one, and time will tell. I mean, I don't claim to have any answers to this thing.
No, that's the thing. I don't think anybody has any answers to this thing at the moment. I'm sadly feeling that there aren't any answers to this thing. That's the problem.
But the core, the big lesson out of all of this is that Lebanon is a new and young and fragile democracy, and we should have been supporting them as a new democracy. Democracies don't spring full-born out of the womb. They don't just, boom, all of a sudden, poof, you've got a strong democracy. I mean, we went through a civil war in this country. We democracies take time, and we haven't been doing what's necessary to support the Lebanese democracy, frankly, and I think that that's what's brought this about.
Maybe there's a lesson for Iraq in all this.
Yeah. Well, the lesson for Iraq is, again, you can't just pull a democracy out of your hat and say, poof, you've got a democracy.
Exactly.
You've got to have the people wanting it. I mean, look at 30 years of civil war in Lebanon to produce the Lebanese democracy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News. Good talking with you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always very thought-provoking. TalkRadioNews.com. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where reason is our lifestyle choice, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 6 minutes past the hour, third hour of our program here. The point that I was starting to get at in the last segment, and I think this is a really important point, and the latest news out of Afghanistan really reinforces this, but also the news out of Lebanon and Israel, and just the whole thing, is that democracy requires the active and aggressive, and I don't mean that in the physically violent way. I mean that in the highly participatory way, the active and aggressive participation of the people. In fact, arguably of the majority of the people. Democracies don't emerge instantly and automatically, and democracy is not just voting. I mean, these are the fundamental mistakes that are made by the neocons and the Bushies, who think that democracy is somehow simply, you know, like we imposed on Iraq, where you now have free trade, anybody can start a corporation, labor trade unions are illegal. That's democracy. No socialism there. You can take all the profit you want out of the country. You can bring in any immigrant from anywhere to work for as cheap as you can find them. No. Democracy, as Alexis de Tocqueville pointed out in 1836 in his book Democracy in America, as Hamilton and Madison pointed out in the Federalist Papers in 1787, as Jefferson wrote throughout his writings, but in particular in his notes on Virginia back in the 1780s. Democracy is something that requires the active participation of people. They, at the grassroots level, people have to get in, they have to get their hands dirty, they have to participate, not just vote. They have to show up, they have to speak out, they have to they have to publish unpleasant truths in newspapers, they have to talk about, you know, what's going on in government, they have to decide collectively what kind of nation they want to be. You have to have an active and free press. I mean, there are a whole series of dimensions that make democracy vital and vibrant. The economic, to some extent, you could say there's a dozen different ways economics could be reinvented and have democracy. You know, for example, in Sweden, the taxes are about 50% of what you earn is taxed. And so what do they? Well, you just pay everybody twice as much as you'd pay if there was no tax at all. And with that tax money, what is done? You have literally cradle-to-grave security. Medical care is free, so when you're born, it's free. Child care is free. So if you want to work, if you want to participate in the workforce, education is free all the way up through PhD. And when you get old and you need to go into a nursing home or into a hospice, that's free. And it's very high quality. So with the fundamentals taken care of, the Swedish people are, you know, free to participate in their democracy and to be creative and energetic and enthusiastic and have all the things that they want out of civil society. So, I mean, or you could argue that, you know, we have a democracy here too. Well, you know, actually, I'm kind of inclined to go back with FDR's notion that a necessitous man is not a free man. But in any case, the point is that democracy takes time. I remember flying across the Atlantic with Dick Gregory back in 1981. We were going to Uganda, and we're on this plane in the middle of the night, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, well into our second glass or maybe third glass of wine, and talking about the Vietnam War and the history of America. This was, as I said, 26 years ago. And he says to me, you know, I don't understand why America wants to run around the world trying to shove our way of life down people's throats with a barrel of a gun. He says, you got something good. You don't have to force it on people. They will steal it. And it's so true. Democracy has to come from within. And so, you know, oh, gee, we're going to impose democracy. We tried imposing democracy on Germany after World War I. Now you're not going to have a Kaiser anymore. And it stuck for what, 15 years? 20 years, something like that. I don't have the whole German timeline in front of me. No more kings? Yeah, right. The German people weren't quite ready for that. They still wanted a king, and they got one in the form of a Führer, which is, of course, the German word for the word leader, which is the word that is used inside the White House to refer to George W. Bush, oddly enough. But in any case, democracy takes time. You can't just say, boom, here's a democracy. And so if Lebanon is going to be a democracy, it needs a lot of help to become a democracy. You don't just walk away and say, okay, they're a democracy now. And you want really clear evidence of this? Look at what's going on in Afghanistan right now. We went into Afghanistan. We bombed the Taliban. We installed Hamid Karzai, the former Unocal oil executive, who's of Afghan ancestry, as the president of the country. And he's now referred to laughingly as the mayor of Kabul because basically he controls two cities, more or less, parts of two cities. And they got together, and in a democracy, they passed a constitution, and the constitution says, by the way, this is an Islamic republic, and nothing shall violate Sharia law. And so now we have this story in today's paper in The Independent. The Afghan government is approving a plan to reintroduce a Department for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. Say what? This has been passed by Hamid Karzai's cabinet. It now goes before the parliament. The Ministry of the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. This was the group of guys who used to drive around in pickup trucks, and if they say with a ruler in one hand and a whip in the other, and they'd run up to men and measure the length of their beards, and if their beard wasn't long enough, they'd rip their shirts open, tie them to the back of the truck, and whip them until they were bleeding. If they got word that some woman was behaving inappropriately, she would become their victim. There were regular executions for things like adultery every Friday in the football stadium, just like they have right now in Saudi Arabia. I just learned over the weekend that in the 1950s was when Saudi Arabia stopped having an open slave market, largely due to U.S. pressure. If you didn't attend prayer five times a day, people from the Department for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice, they would come arrest you. Everybody was spying on everybody. It was particularly difficult for widows. Because under Sharia law, a woman cannot go out anywhere unaccompanied by a man. And if a widow had not only lost her husband but had no sons, or her sons had been taken or lost in war, and so she didn't have a man who was within one generation, who was a father or a son or a husband, if she didn't have a man of that relationship, then she couldn't go outside. Period. Western diplomats have reacted with unease to the proposal. However, several told The Independent that they believe the move was partly designed to defuse Taliban propaganda, which accuses the Karzai government of being un-Islamic. Right, yeah, cave into them. You see, this is what the Democrats do with the Republicans. Oh, yes, Hillary says. We're in favor of a constitutional amendment to ban flag burning. Yes. A diplomat said on the condition of anonymity, hey, this is an Islamic republic and Sharia is part of the Constitution. If it's constitutional and within the framework of the International Convention of Human Rights, then it could represent a public information victory for the government. Right. The article goes on to say, with the Taliban making considerable gains in the south, the Karzai government has been keen to establish a more conservative Islamic profile. Yeah. If we are going to help build democracies, regional democracies, it has to be more than we go in with bombs. This is what George Bush doesn't understand. Bush understands punishment. He understands crime. He understands the word evil. He doesn't understand democracy. The neocons don't understand democracy. They're all about punishment. We should have been helping Lebanon build a democracy. We should have been helping the Palestinians build a democracy. We should have been encouraging democracy in the region. Not by invading Iraq and throwing out Saddam Hussein. Again, it has to be from the bottom up. You encourage the people. We're broadcasting 1 hour, 90 minutes a week into Iran. You want to encourage democracy in Iran? Bring back the Voice of America. We're broadcasting 90 minutes a week into Iran. We could be doing so much more. 16 minutes past the hour. And so much more, not military.
democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. We provide you with a new way to sound off about an issue or topic of the day. By the way, the comment line, the Tom Hartman comment line, just pick up the phone and call 503-323-6620. Give us your take in 30 seconds or less because we want to hear from you. 503-323-6620. Remember, your thoughts and opinions may just make it on the air, so make it count. 503-323-6620, another public service from the Tom Hartman radio program. Dave in Eureka, California. Our number, 866-440-8466. Dave in Eureka. Hey, Dave.
Tom, I'm hoping you might have some more late information than I do on this subject, but one of the mysteries of elections that got left hanging was the 50th Congressional District in San Diego.
You're talking about the Busby-Bilray election.
Correct.
In San Diego.
And one of the things, of course, they didn't trust the voting machines, and she had asked all of her supporters to vote absentee so they would have some kind of paper ballots. But and I guess many of them did. But,
many of them did, and they called the election before the paper ballots had been counted.
And they still haven't counted the paper ballots. But Busby kind of dropped out of sight. But this last weekend, there was a lot of with Democratic talk show people in San Diego, and the subject was largely elections and what can be done about them. And she was interviewed. She was out talking, and the subject of why did you resign before they counted the absentee ballots just wasn't asked. Now, I don't know if she just said, I don't want to address that question.
Advice the Democrats are getting from the Bob Schrum, DLC, Donna Brazile, Democratic consultants, the James Carville types, which is, in my opinion, insane advice.
Ignore the election fraud.
Is exactly right. Ignore the election fraud. You don't want to be painted as a conspiracy nut. And to the best of my knowledge, Dino Rossi in Washington State is not being painted as a conspiracy nut. In fact, in all probability, he's going to run against Christine Gregoire the next time around. And because he's got a lot of people who, you know, on his side, a lot of Republicans on his side who think that the election was stolen. I mean, he pounded that thing for months.
Oh, Lord.
You almost wonder if they're fifth columnists, you know, if there are Democratic consultants whose goal is to destroy the Democratic Party. I don't get it, Dave. I don't have an answer for it. I just don't get it.
Well, your buddy Brad Friedman was down there with it, and I guess he put in a pretty hard several days and got very little sleep, and he said, I am taking a vacation after this. But if we could get a hold of somebody and find out the late info on Busby and why she conceded without...
Yeah, I talked on the phone to Brad on Friday, I think it was. Yeah, it must have been Friday that I talked with him. Who knows? I mean, you know, he didn't know. I don't know. I can tell you the reason why she didn't push this thing is because she figured that, you know, there's going to be another election in November, and she's going to be the Democratic candidate, and she's going to be running against this guy who's the Republican right now. And, you know, better to focus all your effort on winning an election than spend your time, effort, and money, and very valuable money, on trying to contest an election that maybe you actually lost. And I suspect that that's the political calculus behind this. But, you know, I can't speak for the campaign or the candidacy, and they're not speaking to me, so I don't know.
The DLC is getting dumber by the day. I can't believe this is happening. Crooked machines, she's not going to win any election, any place, anytime.
Yeah. There you go. Dave, thanks for the call.
Thank you, bro.
Good talking with you. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. Seems like I've been following up Dave for years now.
Indeed.
I want to play devil's advocate. I enjoyed your talk about democracy before the break. And here's what the Republican/libertarians say about that. I'm sure you've heard this before. We don't live in a democracy. It doesn't mention democracy nowhere in the Constitution.
Right.
Have you heard that one?
Oh, sure. And you've not heard my riff on that?
I haven't heard your reply. Mine is, you know, come on, be real.
Yeah, get over it. In fact, it was this was a great example of the very early use of language. There was concern when the Constitution was being put together about about democracy. There were a lot of people who were very afraid of a democracy. They were afraid of mob rule. You had like John Adams. You had the conservatives, basically, of the
right.
day, Alexander Hamilton, who were very concerned about the rabble, as John Adams referred to people like you and me.
Right.
And so James Madison, in 1787, if you were to look in a dictionary under the word democracy or republic, you would have found, in republic it would have said see democracy, and democracy would have said see republic, right? In other words, they had identical descriptions.
Okay.
James Madison, in one of the Federalist Papers, I think it was 14, I forget which one, split these two words, turned them into two separate words, and said a democracy is mob rule, and a republic is the rule of law. And everybody, the Federalists, everybody kind of adopted that as a way to sell the Constitution. And for the next 15 or 20 years, nobody used the word democracy. Everybody used the word republic. And in fact, the Democratic Party, today's Democratic Party, was called back then the Democratic Republicans.
Okay.
And which the party founded by Thomas Jefferson. And then in the 1820s, in his old age, James Madison wrote about this. In fact, there's a great book by Robert Dahl called How Democratic is the U.S. Constitution? And he quotes Madison in his old age saying, well, really, we created a democracy. It's really the same thing. It was just that there's this little window of time there for about 20 years when they changed the definitions to sell the Constitution, and that's what the Republicans go back to. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
When your strange faces come out of the rain, when you're strange, no one remembers your name, when you're strange.
And welcome back, Exposing the Con and Conservative. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Gonzo is with us. He's the editor at BuzzFlash.com. Editor, right, Gonzo?
Managing editor.
Managing editor. Thank you very much.
Mark is our editor.
And market director and, you know, all kinds of just kind of general cool stuff there at BuzzFlash.com. And this is our best of the rest of the news segment here for the week. And Gonzo, a lot been going on over the last 7 days here, and particularly over the weekend. What's the general progressive take on what's going on in the Middle East right now?
Well, I think if there's anything to take from this, it's the glaring example that it presents of how our foreign policy is being run by completely disengaged idiots. I mean, there's no interest in peace whatsoever. It's pretty much just let's either create a war or let's just not worry about other wars that are going on.
And interesting. I'm curious if I've been playing with this metaphor in my reading and whatnot. In fact, I was just a few minutes ago. I was reading a website that was talking about. It was a Middle Eastern website. Actually, it's Electronic Intifada is the .net is the website. And there was a piece in here, a reality check, the real three issues between Israel and Lebanon. And they were suggesting that there should be, that Hezbollah should be brought into the Lebanese military, like in past rebel movements all around the world and other governments, you eventually absorb these folks. You know, the IRA being brought into Northern Ireland, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably an imperfect example. You've read millions of stories in the process of putting together BuzzFlash.com. Do you have any sense that a good chunk of what's going on here actually has to do with a battle within Hezbollah for control of Hezbollah between a militant faction that wants to have war and ultimately wants to have a hardline, hardcore Islamic Republic on the one hand, versus another perhaps more moderate faction that is interested in aligning itself with the Lebanese democracy and being part of a democratic institutions?
Well, BuzzFlash's take on this is pretty much that there, if you were able to poll the countries, we believe that there's a vast majority of everybody that wants peace, but that there are some extremist groups in every country that are not interested in that aspect. And, you know, it's going to require diplomacy to work with those people to figure out, you know, what it is that can be given to them that will make them become part of the peace process as opposed to using violence to achieve their end. So I'm not certain that, you know, integrating the more extremist elements of each group into the society will necessarily be the answer. Maybe it's a process of disbanding parts of them as well as integrating parts of them or taking in part of their message. I mean, I just don't think anybody's talking right now.
Yeah, it's trying to boil this down to stuff that is easily understood is not an easy task. I just learned about all these maps of the Israeli landmines that were supposed to be turned over to the Lebanese that were not. Do you know about this?
No, I hadn't heard that.
Oh, this is reading an Arab website that's talking about the complaints that they have. I've read the Israeli websites as well, or the pro-Israel websites that are, you know, the flip side of this, and I'm trying to keep an open mind all the way around, but you know, just here, Israel failed to keep her promise to make available maps of the 140,000 mines she left behind in Lebanon. Three small sectors of land overlooking the Litani River were retained by Israel and were the cause of complaints from the government of Prime Minister Fouad Sinoura, not just Hezbollah. And three Lebanese prisoners were moved by Israel contrary to the Geneva Convention, should have been returned long ago. Now, with Wolf Blitzer on CNN, I heard the number two person in the Lebanese government go off on a rant about all three of these things on Saturday. And yet I've seen no mention of any of this in any of the American media. I'm looking at the Arab press on this. And again, not by way of complaining about Israel. I mean, you know,
right.
Israel certainly, you know, what do you do if, you know, if a Mexican terrorist group had come across the border and attacked, you know, El Paso? I mean, you know, we'd go down and we'd kick their butts. I mean, there's just no two ways about it.
Right.
And we'd all be going, hey, yeah, you know, we got to do something. So it's just, you know, I don't know. Anyhow, what else do you see? What are the other hot? What's the hot news here in BuzzFlash.com right now, Gonzo?
Well, just as far as security goes, our own Homeland Insecurity Department, we just posted a headline that basically shows that New York Times is finally catching up to speed on realizing that there being more terrorist targets in Indiana than in New York and California.
Now, I'm assuming that came about because the congressman or senators from Indiana had enough seniority that they were able to put large earmarks into those spending bills to get more money into their districts to get themselves reelected in the 2006 elections.
There was also not a lot of feedback on what really constitutes a national landmark or a treasure. You know, I don't know if people in India, not anything against IHOPs, but I don't know if maybe, you know, there were some people that had, you know, a 60-year-old IHOP that they thought was a national treasure. And, you know, New York and California were choosing, you know, had a little higher level of threshold of what they considered a possible terrorist.
So in Marietta, Georgia, it's the big chicken, you know, the famous KFC, whereas in New York they'd look around and go, well, there's the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah, that's what I got, the sort of the take on that, is that the Homeland Security Department didn't really give anyone any guidelines on what they should qualify. So Indiana just put everything they could think of, which is, you know, no necessarily fault of theirs, but it ended up with this huge discrepancy between the fact that now they get more money because they need to protect, you know, the Dairy Queen.
Which came first, the request for the list or the knowledge that the size of the list was going to correspond with the size of the money coming with it?
You know, that I don't know. That'd be interesting to find out.
Because I've worked as a consultant for some very, very large corporations and government agencies where, you know, they're trying to get rid of money just before the end of an annual cycle or a quarterly cycle because they know if they don't get rid of it, they won't get the same amount or even
right,
more.
Right, it happened. I was in supply in the military, and they did the same thing.
Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And you know, if I'm a civil defense official in Indiana, and I know that if I put three things on, I'm going to get, you know, $1 million. But if I put 15 things on, I'm going to get $20 million. And I'm interested in building a little empire and having some job security. I'm going to come up with 20 things.
Right.
But what you're saying is that regardless of that, apparently nobody at the Department of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff's agency, bothered to you know, really evaluate these lists or provide any kind of guidelines or criteria.
Right.
Yeah. Amazing.
So he just, you know, he just... you know, it's like we put so much blame on Mike Brown for New Orleans, but Mike Brown was really under Chertoff, and Chertoff pretty much escaped, I would say, most of the scrutiny for that, and he probably deserves as much or more than Mike Brown did for failures in New Orleans.
Well, that's what Brown is saying now. I mean, you know, he's been pretty outspoken about it.
Yeah.
And yeah, so amazing. Other stories over at BuzzFlash.com that you think are, what do you think is the most unreported important story of the last week?
Yeah, you know, I think it's been reported, but I don't think the significance of I still think this whole week has been really about foreign policy and just, you know, and I think North Korea, the missiles. And I'm, even though the UN is working on this, I really don't think it's been pointed out how we blew the chances we had 5 or 6 years ago, and that Bush has dropped the ball on this, and that this is it goes back to his inability to engage in diplomacy and hit the swagger, you know, pull your gun at every chance. Foreign policy that comes out of the Bush administration is just keeps leading to more and more either warfare or leads to, you know, this, the raising of arms in the process of warfare. So I think the North Korea thing is just another, it's sort of, because the UN has sort of taken some control over it, it's kind of, we've kind of lost sight of the U.S.'s involvement in it. And I think that's been sort of underreported as far as our screw-ups in that.
Interesting. Interesting. Let me get back over to BuzzFlash here. There were a couple of stories that I thought were, the administration wants AT&T's case moved to a secret court.
Yeah.
What's the deal here?
Well, the AT&T case is the one trying to keep the information from. We're talking about the same case.
We're spying on your phone records.
Right, and there's the case where the guy, the whistleblower case, involved in that, and they obviously going to pull a national security thing because enough information is out about that it's very certain that they have these special rooms in more than one location where they can tap into your into the communication lines. There's even a website that you can go to, and I don't know if it's been up in a couple of days, but you can go to it and you can type in your IP address and watch the trace route and see if it goes through the node or the transfer station that is affiliated with this particular
the NSA
issue. Yeah, the NSA.
Is there a link to that off BuzzFlash.com?
There is. I don't know if there is right now. It was up last week, but it's related to this. I'll try and find it and put it back up.
Yeah. I suspect that a lot of our listeners are going to be looking at it shortly after we get off the air. The flu pandemic preparations. There's an article on BuzzFlash about this.
Well, to be honest with you, I'm not completely up to speed on the flu pandemic issues.
Okay. Well, that's okay. We're out of time as it is. Gonzo, the managing editor over at BuzzFlash.com. Gonzo, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. You have a great day.
You too. BuzzFlash.com, great news source. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back in just a few minutes here on the Tom Hartman program. The vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I miss Monica. I miss Monica. I miss Monica. I miss Monica. GW's just logic. It's kind of hard to follow. It's almost pathological in all its promises and hollow. And the lies he tells would be hard to swallow. Even for Monica.
Oh,
dear,
no.
Sweet Monica.
Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. That was some of the strangest bumper music in the world. Kathy Cassavant is with us. Kathy, am I pronouncing your last name right?
You've got it right.
Okay, great. Kathy Cassavant, she's the director of the Voice at Work campaign with the AFL-CIO. The website, AFLCIO.org/joinaunion/voice-at-work. And Kathy, tell us about the program.
The program for the AFL-CIO is to ensure that organizing is a part of everything that unions and that that labor organizations in this country do, that everything that we talk about and everything we do is related to the fact that workers do need a voice at work, and we want to be able to help them get that.
And the Kentucky River, these so-called Kentucky River decisions that the NLRB, they have not yet decided on these, have they? Have they conclusively ruled on them?
No, they haven't. The troubling thing for us is that they've even refused, the National Labor Relations Board, they've even refused to hear oral arguments on these cases. And people aren't going to have the opportunity, and attorneys aren't going to have the opportunity to actually make the case as to why the elimination of supervisors within the act will be a huge problem. Last week, thousands of nurses and construction workers and communications workers took place in actions all over the country to protest the fact that that the board won't even hear them in terms of these decisions that we think will probably take place around Labor Day that would, in fact, eliminate supervisors from either being in a union if they're currently in one, or, in fact, disallow workers who would like to be in a union who happen to be supervisors from actually joining a union.
So they're basically saying, don't confuse us with the facts. We've already made up our mind?
That's what we feel, and that's the part that, again, is troubling. Actually, 30 labor lawyers just recently signed a letter to the NLRB asking them to delay the decision in terms of the oral argument piece because we need this to get done. The Bush board just continues one thing after the other to try to strip workers' rights. 2004, they issued three decisions. You know, one, that graduate teaching assistants can't be in unions. Another, that disabled workers, if they're receiving rehabilitative services from their employer, can't be in unions. And temp workers could no longer be in unions. And now they're going to add to the list supervisors who do the work that they've always done to be eliminated from the act as well.
Amazing. Amazing. So, Kathy Cassavant, what can people do?
What people can do is call their congressman and tell their congressman to please call Chairman Batista at the National Labor Relations Board and demand that they hear oral arguments on these cases.
Okay, great. And the toll-free number for Congress is 1-888-355-3588. And that'll get you to who. And if you don't know the name of your member of Congress, just give them your zip code. They'll connect you.
Great.
So
that'll be a huge help.
Indeed. And so just call your member of Congress and tell them, once again, Kathy, tell them what?
Tell them to call Chairman Batista of the National Labor Relations Board and demand that they hear oral arguments on the Kentucky River cases.
Great. Kathy Cassavant with the AFL-CIO. You can learn more about it at AFLCIO.org. Kathy, thanks so much for
being
here.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
And once again, that toll-free number for Congress, 1-888-355-3588. Great talking with you, Kathy.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye now. Indeed, it is amazing. Time now for our activism alert.
May take a week, damn it. May take longer. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over. Come on!
Yeah, here's how we're taking on the stem cell research. Right now it's known as H.R. 810. There will be a Senate version of it. It has passed the House of Representatives. It's coming before the Senate. Make sure that your senator supports it. Call your senator. Again, same number, 1-888-355-3588, toll free to Capitol Hill. And each one of us has two senators, unless you live in Washington, D.C., and in which case you can call any senator. Not that they represent you, but you can call any senator. And so, you know, call your senator and say, hey, support stem cell research. Or you could call the White House and say, George, don't make this the first veto of your career. Come on, you don't want to do that. Rama in Williamstown, Vermont. Hey, Rama, we have about a minute left. What's on your mind?
Okay, Tom, going back to the Busby Bilbrey thing, and this morning I was listening to Deb Markowitz on the radio here on DEV.
She's the Secretary of State in Vermont.
Correct. And she was talking about, you know, she was giving lip service to people's concerns about the voting issues of today, but she, apparently Markowitz has been chosen as either the chair or the president or whatever of the National Secretary of State's organization. And she has no intention of pushing the issue, she stated outright. So, I mean, she's willing to give it lip service, but when it comes down to actually doing something, she doesn't really want to go out and push the issue.
That's a shame, because I you know, I know Deb Markowitz and her husband as well, and she's a very, very smart lady, and I'm surprised.
Yeah, and it's nothing personal against her. I like her. I happen to have met her personally on a number of occasions. I just would not vote for her, I'll tell you the truth. I think this is something that's endemic within the Democratic Party, and the Republicans are now getting ready to pull it out of their folder to fight with.
Oh, they're going to. Yeah. You bet you're wrong. In the 2006 election, what the Republicans, and I've heard this from the inside, what the Republicans are going to do in the 2006 election is they're going to, if they lose the House or the Senate, they're going to take those races where they lost by the smallest margin, and they're going to do the same thing that Rossi did against Gregoire in Washington State, only they're going to, with the hope that they can actually be successful in at least one of them.
You're going to
hear Republicans screaming about vote fraud loudly and repeatedly in the 2006 elections if they lose either the House or Senate. Bet on it. Tomorrow, coming up for the next Tom Hartman program, I'll be debating conservative Steve Ganster on the values of free trade and China. And conservatives said to our friend Jeff Cohen, go to Venezuela, you idiot. He accepted their challenge. Find out what Jeff discovered in Venezuela. That and more and your calls here on the Tom Hartman program. Remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.